Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Francis Alonso reporting. Authorities in Pakistan say two suicide bombings outside Christian churches in the eastern city of Lahore have killed at least 15 people and wounded more than 70 others. A militant gang allied to the Pakistani Taliban has claimed responsibility. Ayaz Ghul reports.
The bombings minutes apart targeted a Catholic and a Protestant church in a majority Christian suburb, Johannesburg, where thousands of people had gathered for Sunday services. Hospital officials say many of those wounded in the attack are in critical condition. A senior Lahore police officer, Heather Ashraf, says two gunmen wearing suicide vests tried to shoot their way into the worship places. He said one police officer was killed and several others sustained injuries while successfully preventing the bombers from entering the prayer halls and limiting the damage. With nearly 1 million people, the Johannesburg area has one of Pakistan's largest Christian communities. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
As Syria enters a fifth year of civil war, Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States will have to reach a deal with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to enable a political transition of power and to stop the crippling of a conflict that has left thousands of people dead. Assad is under fierce domestic and international scrutiny, including allegations of human rights abuses. The Kurdish government in Iraq says it has evidence that Islamic State militants used a chemical weapon against Kurdish Peshmerga forces. The Kurdistan Region Security Council released a statement Saturday alleging that chlorine gas was used in a January suicide bombing in northern Iraq. However, the allegation by the Kurdish government could not be independently verified. This is VOA News. The White House wants Congress to stop interfering in the negotiations with Iran about its nuclear capabilities. White House Chief of Staff Dennis McDonough warned Congress in a letter sent late Saturday that pending legislation requiring congressional approval for any deal reached with Iran about its nuclear capabilities could have a profoundly negative impact on the negotiations. White House officials have said President Barack Obama would veto the proposed legislation. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry travels to Switzerland Sunday for another round of talks with his Iranian counterpart in an attempt to reach an interim deal with Iran on its nuclear program by March 31st. A U.S. delegation travels to Cuba today for a third round of talks between the two countries about reestablishing diplomatic relations and easing economic and travel sanctions imposed decades ago. Cuba's lead negotiator has said a U.S. decision to remove Cuba from a state-sponsored list of terrorism is not a precondition for reestablishing ties. Josefina Vidal is the chief of the Cuban Foreign Ministry U.S. Division.
So you can reestablish relations and then go on to the next step of opening embassies. So what we are saying, yes, it's not a precondition, it's not a condition, but what we say is that an important, very important issue for Cuba, I can say that it's a priority for Cuba.
A number of Cuban Americans and others oppose relaxing relations between Washington and Havana because they feel it legitimizes Cuba's communist government. Relief supplies began flowing into Vanuatu Sunday after a devastating tropical cyclone slammed into the South Pacific island late Friday and Saturday. Cyclone Pam, carrying winds up to 300 kilometers per hour, destroyed entire villages. Authorities have confirmed at least 8 deaths. In Japan Sunday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke about help for Vanuatu.
The United Nations stands ready to help people affected by this and other disasters. And I have already instructed dispatching some of experts and aid workers of the United Nations. They will take all necessary measures and mobilizing support for people of Vanuatu.
Vanuatu's authorities have declared a state of emergency. 10 U.S. aid workers who may have been exposed to Ebola in Sierra Leone are being evacuated to the United States. U.S. officials said Saturday that those individuals will be housed near the University of Nebraska Medical Center. The National Institutes of Health in Maryland or Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, all three have been used to treat American Ebola patients. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
For the vice president to fear for his life. The reason being he remains to be the incumbent vice president. He was only expelled from the All People's Congress Party.
Sierra Leonean vice president requests asylum despite President Ernest Bai Koroma's assurance of his security.
No evidence has been established to corroborate that these persons were deliberately killed.
Cameroon denies its military systematically executes Boko Haram suspects.
فالإحصاءات تشير إلى أن عدد سكان مصر تحت سن 40 عاما.
Mr. Sisi noted that Egypt has a workforce of 30 million young people.
And the Egyptian government receives financial and moral support from our international partners. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leonean President Ernest Bai Koroma says embattled Vice President Sam Sumana should not fear for his life or feel threatened by the prevailing conditions in the country. Government spokesman Abdoulaye Barete told me earlier that there is no reason why Vice President Samuel Sam Sumana should fear for his life due to the president's assurance.
There is no reason for the Vice President to fear for his life. The reason being he remains to be the incumbent Vice President. He was only expelled from the All People's Congress Party, the party under whose ticket he came into governance. But so far, when the news came, I immediately had a chat with the president himself, Dr. Ernest Bai Koroma, who said there is no reason for the vice president to feel threatened, and because he can assure his safety and security, and that the issue about him even saying he wanted political asylum from the U.S. embassy is a little bit exaggerated. The reason being, there is no reason for that.
Well, there were reports that his bodyguards were changed without his knowledge or perhaps approval, despite the fact that as the vice president, he has supervision over some security aspects of the country. So why was his bodyguard changed without him being notified?
Well, normally, as it happened quite recently, just a week ago with President Koroma, few months ago, we announced to the public that new security arrangements have been put in place, wherein we have a joint leadership of the Sierra Leone police and the military. They are now in charge of the very presidential fleet of guards. And the president's guards were changed, just as how any other minister's guards will change. When it comes to that, it is more of an internal security arrangement and decision undertaken by the Sierra Leone police without having to consult the politicians. So this is what happened. And besides, the vice president is also on quarantine, which means some of those guards that are already also in quarantine, they'll need to disarm them so that they can redeploy other people with harm just to ensure the continued safety of the vice president himself.
Since he has about 4 days left to conclude his self-imposed quarantine, why wouldn't this move, be put on hold? Why the haste?
Well, that will better be answered by the Sierra Leone police. As I mentioned, those are security arrangements. They decide when to rotate guards. They decide when to detail new guards. Even when the guards of the president were changed and others detailed, the president himself was never informed because it is an internal arrangement done by the Sierra Leone police. And I can say this is also a similar situation. I want to reiterate what President Koroma has said personally and publicly, that there is no cause for alarm for the safety of the vice president because he was only expelled from the ruling party, of which he was a bona fide member, until when his expulsion came. And he still remains the vice president until when people have started challenging the constitutionality of him continuing to be a vice president because he came under the ticket of a political party which has expelled him. But that is another cup of tea altogether.
Some Sierra Leoneans I spoke with said the latest development of him fearing for his life, going into hiding, seeking for political asylum, is an embarrassment to the people of Sierra Leone and to the government. What is your take on that?
Well, my take on that is, as I mentioned to you, the ambassador to Sierra Leone even called President Nkrumah, and President Nkrumah, in my presence, assured him that everything is okay and there is no cause for alarm, and the vice president should continue to live his normal life.
The vice president supporters are saying that the change of guard and alleged witch hunting being perpetrated by the president and his administration are politically motivated to get rid of him.
Well, as I mentioned to you, he was only expelled from the party, that is the All People's Congress Party, and they came up with a press release wherein they detailed all the reasons for his expulsion. But I will not concentrate more on that. I'll rather concentrate on the security of the vice president, because I just spoke with him and I spoke with the wife 30 minutes ago and they sounded very okay. So that is a real demonstration that we are in touch with him and he feels secure where he is.
Abdoulaye Barrette is the spokesman for the Sierra Leone government. He spoke with me earlier from the capital, Freetown. The Nigerian Ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, and main opposition All Progressive Congress, APC, have intensified their campaigns in the run-up to the March 28 presidential election. For the latest update, Ide Felix Igwabo, a journalist and social commentator, joins us live via telephone link-up from the capital, Abuja. Good evening, Ide. Hello, Ide, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you very well.
All right. Now, Ide, let me ask you, in your view, how are the two competing campaigns faring ahead of the election?
Well, the truth of the matter is that it's been a very heated campaign, but I believe that many Nigerians are now beginning to see very clearly that whereas one party has been struggling to put out its record of achievements in the last 4 years, the other party has said the current government has achieved absolutely nothing. And that being so, common sense tells most people that it is not possible for a government to be in power for 4 years and just do absolutely nothing. Aside of that, the APC has been too high on propaganda, too much of lies, too much of misinformation. Everything that is has happened in this country has become a topic for the campaign. And the Nigerians resent that. And they are beginning to now see very clearly that somebody somewhere is not being very sincere with the electorate.
No, but Ide, let me ask you this. The opposition leader, General Muhammadu Buhari, has said he is not deterred by the PDP ongoing smearing campaign to discredit him and make him unpopular ahead of the election. Why would the PDP do so if the ruling party is indeed confident of winning the presidential election? Is the PDP panicking in this case?
What they call smear campaigns are actually the, call it exposés. Buhari doesn't want anything about, if he wants anything about his life hidden and kept secret, then he mustn't come out to run for president. By coming out to run for the president, you have agreed to subject yourself to public scrutiny.
But the latest development...
It is not the PDP.
The latest development shows that political momentum is on the side of General Muhammadu Buhari. So the PDP had to basically put a chalk hold on him. Is this why the smearing campaign is, you know, has generated so much heat?
Peter, I don't agree with you that there is a smear campaign. It is on both sides. Like I said to you yesterday, the president has been called all kinds of names, and he has continued to be president. It is a campaign. Buhari, if he wants anything about him hidden, then he mustn't put himself forward for the election. He's stumbling. He's making mistakes. What is the name of your of your running mate, Professor Yemi Osinbajo. What is the name of INEC, Nigerian Independent Electoral? That you see, these are not things that people have forced him to say. These are things that he has stumbled on himself. And you know as well as I do that in an electionary period like this, all you need to lose the election is to make a big slip.
Now,
so it has nothing to do with the PDP.
A cross-section of Nigerians have said that there is an orchestrated attempt by the PDP stalwart to sponsor ethnic militias to disrupt the elections. What are you seeing on the ground?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't know where these allegations come from. I am in Abuja. Abuja is peaceful. Now, the information I have is that the Nigerian Armed Forces with their other the neighbors from Cameroon, Mali, Chad, and so on are beginning to rout out Boko Haram. They fled Boko Haram essentially now, totally from Adamawa, and it is just pockets of resistance that are remaining in Borno State. Where they get all these bizarre stories, I don't know. But to tell you the truth, there's absolutely no truth to it, even though I don't speak for the government nor for the security agencies. There's no truth to it.
Is the Independent National Electoral Commission, in this case INEC, is INEC ready to administer a credible election?
Well, the truth of the matter is that INEC may have shot itself on the foot because after it rescheduled the elections that were previously to hold February 14th, we found out that there were a lot of things that they had started to do that were yet undone. So how were they going to tell Nigerians that they were ready to conduct the elections? Now, at the moment, it is the cadre that is on the front burner. Now, the Section 56 of the amended electoral law says electronic voting is completely illegal. Now, if you say you are going to introduce card readers and then electronically transmit messages to your headquarters, to your server, is that not electronical? In any case, this issue is debatable. But tell you what, to my mind, I think that INEC is more ready now than they were February 14th. In another 1 or 2 weeks, I think we should substantially be ready to conduct free, fair, credible, and acceptable elections. I have no doubt in my mind.
Thank you very much. Ide Felix Igwabo is a journalist and social commentator. He joined us live from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Cameroon has strongly denied allegations that its military systematically executes Boko Haram suspects. Human rights groups in the Central African nation have asked the UN to investigate possible war crimes following reports that hundreds of suspects were executed near Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria, an area known to be a Boko Haram stronghold. VOA Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Cameroon government spokesman and communication minister Issa Chiruma Bakari said reports by rights groups that the country summarily executes Boko Haram suspects are unfounded. Speaking to reporters Friday, Chiruma said Boko Haram prisoners are treated humanely and will be tried according to the laws of the land. Chiruma rejected a report published by the regional human rights group REDAC in January accusing Cameroon's military of gross abuses against Boko Haram suspects. However, he admitted some of the suspects the rights groups said were killed were found dead in a detention cell in December, a day after they were arrested.
In the early morning, it was noticed that 25 out of the 56 had died. The request forensic doctor expert perform autopsies on the corpses and order their burial.
Chiruma said the Cameroon government had opened investigations to determine the cause of their deaths and said a senior military official he refused to name had been arrested.
I can already state here that at this stage of investigation, no evidence has been established to corroborate that these persons were deliberately killed. While waiting, the commander of the Far North Gendarmerie Legion at the time of the incident has been sacked and handed over to competent court for further investigations.
He did not try to explain how the suspects might have died. Redact said in its report that the Cameroon military intimidated and tortured suspects to obtain information and that 50 prisoners were suffocated. Cameroon, Chad, and Nigerian soldiers early this year launched a three-nation offensive against Boko Haram, fighting to create an Islamist caliphate. Non-governmental organizations and civilians complained innocent people were either killed or arrested. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Egypt's Arab neighbors and international partners, including the United States, gathered in the Sinai resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh Friday. This to pledge economic and moral support for rebuilding the tattered Egyptian economy through investment, restructuring and transparency. For VOA, Edward Iranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ashab al-Galalati wal-Fakhamati wal-Sumu. As-Sayyidatu wa-Sada.
President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi opened the economic conference with a pledge to reform and modernize the workings of Egypt's economy and appealed to international allies to invest in his country's future prosperity. Mr. Sisi noted that Egypt has a workforce of 30 million young people. He said his government was aiming to create 6% economic growth over the next 5 years to build jobs and cut unemployment to 10%. He said Egypt has been faithful in repaying its international obligations and seeks to build confidence and trust. The government, he insisted, has revamped laws to streamline the investment process and eliminate potential dangers for companies doing business in Egypt. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry pledged American support for Egypt's bid to reform and rebuild its economy, saying the country's future political success depends on strong economic growth.
Egypt obviously needs to grow inclusively, and President al-Sisi is committed to that. A central demand of the revolution of 2011 was a more equal distribution of wealth, and that requires a commitment to empowering young people to fulfill their dreams, to meet their aspirations, and women also, in order to promote a free and active and independent civil society.
Secretary Kerry also blasted the Islamic State group and other Islamic militants for their efforts to destroy the fundamental bases of modern society and vowed to stop them from plunging the Middle East into the darkness and chaos of the past.
The road ahead is absolutely clear, and so is the United States' determination to support Egypt's progress in any way that we can. And that includes in the effort to stand up and fight against extremists and terrorists. Here at this conference, we stand in direct contradiction to the nihilism that they present. They want to destroy and go back in time. We want to build and go to the future. And that's what this conference is about.
Saudi Crown Prince Mukran bin Abdulaziz denounced what he called double standards in fighting terrorism and went on to pledge $4 billion in aid and investment to support the Egyptian economy. Kuwait's Emir Sabah Ahmed al-Sabah and the leader of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid al-Maktoum, also pledged similar amounts. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And it has been said that Rwandan President Paul Kagame runs his country in the same style a CEO runs a company. But last week, Mr. Kagame publicly chided top membership of his cabinet for incompetence at a leadership meeting. VOA's Jackson Mvunganyi spoke to two Rwandan analysts, Professor Christopher Kayumba and Rama Isibo, on their takeaways from President Kagame's reaction.
The way the government understands and explains it is kind of a governance tool to help government as a whole, main leaders in government institutions, ministries, to meet and plan together, to meet and think about the main programs that government intends to implement, to set priorities, and also to hold each other to account. So it is generally a governance tool, a forum where government officials set priorities and agree that we will do A, B, C, D, and agree to hold each other to account.
So in management terms, it's a strategy meeting?
You could say that, but the other element that I didn't bring in, it is also understood as a homegrown initiative. We have a number of homegrown governance initiatives like Umushikirano, we have governance initiatives even in the judicial system like Gacaca, we have Abunzi. So it is also understood as a tool, a local tool that helps people in government, that helps government to think together. Therefore, you can you could say it is a management tool.
Let me bring you in, Rama, here. I know you are a history buff. Do we know of Imwiherero anywhere in Rwandan culture, in Rwandan history?
Yeah, a lot of these, Professor Kayumba called tools, are actually old institutions from back in the day, dating back centuries. And every year, you know, during our monarchy long time ago, there used to be like a self-appraisal and an appraisal of all officials. And it could be at a make or break time for like many people because you are being assessed over the whole year that has happened before.
Why was this specific one special? I mean, in the diaspora, it made news because of the president's tone while addressing the other leaders in the meeting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
For me, the most interesting element, the reason I think this meeting was special and I regard it as the most remarkable, in no uncertain terms, the president refused to accept that 70% delivery on government programs is something to be celebrated. If you look at governance delivery of services across Africa, the most important problem is not lack of policies, good policies written down in books. The most important challenge is not putting what has been agreed in practice and achieving results. Therefore, for the president to have refused to be satisfied by 70%, to me, is extremely good. Number two, the president says that leaders must accept criticism and learn from criticism. And for me, bearing in mind our culture, bearing in mind the importance of free expression, bearing in mind the importance of the media in creating an environment whereby the citizenry, the leadership, can talk about different issues, I thought this is extremely good.
You have a problem with people a whole year in which to come up with an excuse. So even the president was worried that this is just becoming a talk shop where we just repeat the same questions and the same problems over again. And then we said, yeah, we had a meeting about it, we discussed about it, and we didn't have any resolution, we didn't move in any way forward, but, you know, we had a meeting about it. So in a way, we should focus. The way Western countries and developed countries became developed was not by accepting 70%. It was accepted by even, you know, you can even get 110%. It's not that 100% is the top ceiling. We can end up getting 110% efficiency. So the president was talking about setting higher goals and standards for you. Don't compare yourself to other banana republics and say, oh, we're doing very well. Because, you know, just Burundi next door or DR Congo next door, they have maybe 10-15% government delivery. We have to aim higher and maximize that potential. What we have right now are problems that are not necessarily policy problems, but people problems.
You heard Rwandan analysts Professor Christopher Kayumba and Rama Isibu. They spoke with viewers Jackson Vunganyi from the capital, Kigali. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Ademi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos and join Segun Ademi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, March 15th. Host Senegal and multiple winner Nigeria have qualified for the semifinals of the ongoing 2015 Africa Under-20 Championship. Senegal beat the Republic of Congo 4-3 on Saturday in their final Group A match in the capital city of Dakar, to finish on 4 points, good enough for a second place on the table. Nigeria tops the group on 7 points after playing 2-2 with Ivory Coast in Mbor, which is 80 kilometers from Dakar, also on Saturday. Ivory Coast and Congo were eliminated. Senegal and Nigeria joined Ghana and Mali, which earlier qualified in the semifinals. All the four semifinalists have also won the tickets to the 2015 FIFA Under-20 World Cup, to be hosted by New Zealand from May 30th to June 20th. Zambia and South Africa were eliminated from Group B. After host Senegal reached the last four of the African tournament, Captain Alassane Sylla expressed satisfaction with the team's performance. It was not an easy game. We had to fight till the end to achieve the result we ended. We did our best and we got victory at the end. I'm happy we have qualified and sad at the same time, because I cannot play in the semis due to suspension, he said. Meanwhile, President Issa Hayatou of African Soccer's governing body, CAF, has hailed Senegal over its organization of the African Under-20 Championship. Speaking after meeting with Senegal's President Macky Sall in Dakar on Friday, Hayatou said without mincing words, what Senegal has done is worthy of praise. They did not only organize it well, but also built new infrastructure that allowed the CAF and the country to organize this event, which is very important to the youth of our continent, he said. In a related development, Senegal is set to replace the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo, as host of the 2015 edition of the African Under-23 Championship. Senegal accepted a request from CAF to host the competition in December, following a meeting on Friday between CAF President Issa Hayatou and President Macky Sall of Senegal. The tournament also doubles as the qualifiers for the football events of the 2016 Olympics. DR Congo withdrew as hosts because of the country's general elections next year. Away from the African Football Championships now, Clive Barker, the most successful coach of South Africa, was fired on Friday as boss of struggling Premiership club Mpumalanga Black Aces. The club, which is based in the northeastern city of Nelspruit, has recorded no victory in 8 league matches, taking just 3 points from a possible 24. A 2-1 midweek loss to Ajax Cape Town left Aces only 1 point above the relegation zone. The club's technical director, Jacob Sakala, takes over from the 70-year-old Barker, who has been offered an unspecified role at the club. Barker coached host South Africa to the 1996 Africa Cup of Nations title, just 5 years after the country was readmitted to international football, following decades of apartheid-induced isolation. Bafana Bafana also qualified for the 1998 World Cup under Barker, but he did not make it to the finals, having been sacked following a poor Confederations Cup showing. In other news, Russia is planning an international anti-racism summit this year to try and get on top of the problem before hosting the 2018 World Cup. The conference is a response to a report which detailed more than 200 cases of discriminatory behavior linked to Russian soccer over the past 2 years. Finally, the Brazilian city of Sao Paulo may not host football games for the 2016 Olympics. This is because of the high cost involved in the competition, city officials said. South America's biggest city had been considered a sure bet as one of the football host cities for the 2016 Rio Games. But officials now say they will have to analyze the list of requirements for the tournament to see if it would be possible to participate. FIFA's Olympic Organizing Committee will meet in Zurich, Switzerland next week to discuss the issue and possibly make a recommendation. Football is the only Olympic competition that will be played outside of Rio. There is a need for several host cities because the tournament is played with 16 nations in the men's side and 12 in the women's. The competition will be extra special for Brazil's national team as it is the only significant football tournament it has never won. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Na bidii paila biso Botelema Boningana Bobina La musique à Oliver Ngoma
Misa beulo mbatitile lomo mbulongubwe Mbatitile lomo mbatitimbongo amuru kwanga Ukanyo nikuye bailo Mbati murime umwege Ukanyo nikuye bailo Mbati murime umwege
Julie Mubenga, Tonton Mayala.
Chachombalo langu isinga ye, na bolingo na ya butu he. Bolingo etonda affection boye na nunazwate, utana bota mana libumu ya mama ye.
Tonino Fernando.
Na bosa na kombo ya chachombala na monoko, na koma kopenga ye chifre 3. Na ndoto na lota kibakola kisanga elembo ya chifre 3. Na yebite so kibikolo misato ye, sanza misato, tompembula misato, kobandeko.
Joli mwadi.
Na keiko tuna ojepe plasida so sola mwali kambo ye.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Eritrea and its long-term president, Isaias Afwerki, managed to enjoy a very brief period of international acclaim after its independence in May 1993, following an overwhelming support for independence in a referendum supervised by the United Nations. Although the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, EPLF, and the Eritrean People's Liberation Front, EPLF, jointly defeated the Mogadishu regime in May 1991, Mr. Afwerki accepted the appeal of the United Nations that Eritrea should attain its independence only after a UN-organized referendum in accordance with UN resolutions. In those halcyon times, President Afwerki was widely seen as a fresh and pleasant face among African leaders. He even maneuvered to share common grounds with the United States on the problem of Somalia. Eritrea, Ethiopia, and the United States were skeptical about the management of the UN peacekeeping force in Somalia. Then things began to fall apart. There was a fallout with the United States and an unexpected dispute with the late Prime Minister Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia. What followed was the war with Yemen and a bitter war with Ethiopia. Today, President Afwerki has a very bad press in the international media. Eritrea is now accused of being an uncontrollable autocratic regime where basic human rights are violated and where no press freedom exists. Those who know President Afwerki very well will confide in you that President Afwerki is an exceedingly stubborn man and that he does not tolerate contrary views. But it is important to record that no one has come forward with any credible evidence to demonstrate or show that he is a corrupt man. Nevertheless, in the pantheon of much criticized African leaders in the mainly Western media, President Afwerki would easily rank after President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe and President Omar Bashir of the Sudan. With all these factors as a background, it was indeed an unexpected surprise that Eritrea has achieved 3 of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, MDGs, ahead of the 2015 schedule. The 3 MDGs Eritrea has achieved are all related to the health sector, reducing infant child mortality by 2/3, MDG 4, improve maternal health, MDG 5, and combating HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other diseases, MDG 6. In 4 other MDG areas, Eritrea is on target and it may be recalled. In 4 other MDG areas, Eritrea is on target. It may be recalled that in the current Ebola crisis in 3 West African countries, the common problem was weak health sector. And here, Eritrea is doing much in that sector. In this regard, it is important to note that in another country which is much criticized, Cuba, they too have made much progress in the health sector. Will this achievement change the judgment about Eritrea? Definitely not. Despite its significance, the achievement may be played down. The reason might well be that President Afwerki is not about to change his pattern of governance. But does he care for his people? In looking ahead, Africans should be mindful of what happened to the former leader of Singapore. Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew was Prime Minister from 1959 to 1990 when he resigned, and after that, he remained in the cabinet as a senior minister. But for most of his rule in the 70s and 80s, he was maligned in section of the international media of being a dictator, a socialist, and a violator of human rights. But today, the international community recognizes the great achievements of that country in Asia. The majority of African states have fallen short of meeting the Millennium Development Goals. And it is remarkable that Eritrea, despite all its faults, has been able to achieve 3 of the most significant goals. I thank you.
Thank you very much. And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Rob McLean, we say thanks for joining us. And as the elders in Zimbabwe say, one's neighbor's problems do not induce one to lose one's appetite. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. 27 years ago, on March 16, 1988, the regime of then-president of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, committed one of the worst atrocities of the modern era, the murder by poison gas of thousands of civilians in the Kurdish-Iraqi town of Halabja. As part of the Al-Anfal operation, a genocidal campaign against the Kurds and other ethnic groups in northern Iraq, government forces spent 2 days shelling the city of Halabja with rockets and napalm, an incendiary gel that sticks to skin and causes terrible burns. But come early evening of the second day, March 16th, they suddenly changed tactics. Attacking aircraft began to pepper the civilian parts of the city with canisters of chemical weapons, including mustard gas and the nerve agents sarin, tabun, and VX. That day, some 3,500 to 5,000 people died within minutes. Another 7,000 to 10,000 were injured, crippled, or suffered long-term health problems. Although there is some evidence that Saddam Hussein's forces had used chemical agents before March 16, 1988, the attack on Halabja is thought to be the Al-Anfal campaign's first documented assault using chemicals, but it would not be the last. Early in 1987, Saddam Hussein authorized the use of chemical weapons in attacks on as many as 24 Kurdish villages. For his role in these heinous attacks, the dictator's cousin and the campaign's commander, Ali Hassan al-Majid, earned the nickname Chemical Ali. Al-Anfal was a series of horrific crimes perpetrated by Iraqi leaders against their own civilian population, and the gassing of the citizens of Halabja was that campaign's worst atrocity. For his part in it, and for other crimes, Chemical Ali was executed by hanging. The Iraqi Special Tribunal dropped charges against Saddam Hussein himself only because he was executed after being convicted in a separate case. The head of government has a responsibility to the country and to its people to act in their best interest. Ultimately, few dictators die in bed or exit the scene of their crimes gracefully. The fate of those who instigated the Al-Anfal and killed thousands of innocents in Halabja should serve as a warning to others who follow in their murderous footsteps.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.